Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hi everybody, producer Al here, and it's time for another re-release of our series TSFP Presents Classic Teams. This time it's quite simply one of the best teams in the history of football. It's Cruyff's dream team at Barca from the late 80s through to the early 90s, the winners of Barcelona's first ever European Cup. Remember, for full access to our entire archive of TSFP Presents, plus Rincón Cultural, my paper reviews, Q&A pods, bonus pods, Zoom calls, all that sort of thing, join us at patreon.com/TSFP.
Hello patrons, and welcome to another edition of TSFP Presents Classic Teams. In our previous episode, we discussed Super Depor and Euro Depor, who excited and enthralled us at the start of the current century and the end of the previous one. This episode, we're going back in time once more to talk about Barcelona's dream team, the incredible side that was assembled by Johan Cruyff at the end of the 1980s and towards the mid of the 1990s, that swept all before them, certainly domestically, with four consecutive league titles at the start of the 1990s.
I think first things first, good name, innit?
What, dream team?
It's a good name.
If you're going to be TSFP Presents Classic Teams.
That's more debatable. But yeah, if you're going to be considered a legendary team, I think it's important to have a catchy name. And dream team. Yeah. Of course, they weren't the original dream team.
Well, that was the whole point, wasn't it? That this is on the basis of the US basketball team at the 1992 Olympics, which of course was in Barcelona, being called the dream team because of them being able to take professional players for the first time. So a team with Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and so on. And so that created this idea that a perfect team would be called that. Of course, 92 is the year that Barcelona win the European Cup. It's that sense that the kind of the two things went together, because I think with time maybe we've forgotten, although if you go to Barcelona and ask people, they certainly haven't, but the 1992 Olympic Games in the city were absolutely enormous in kind of social and cultural terms, as well obviously as economic ones.
Sid, of course, has written a book called Fear and Loathing in La Liga. I don't know if you've read it. We all certainly haven't, and it's excellent.
I haven't, is it?
Yes. There is obviously a chapter on Barcelona's dream team in it. So yeah, you have researched this. You didn't need to bring any notes to today.
No, not really. I did note down a couple of things because there were a couple of details that I wanted to remember, the kind of the statistical significance of it. And I just want to very, very briefly throw this in there, because obviously you talk about a team that wins a European Cup, reaches another European Cup final and loses it in Athens, obviously in 94, and wins four leagues in a row. But to kind of give a sense of the context of that...
Well, and a Copa del Rey and a Cup Winners' Cup.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And that in a way is what starts it, because the Cup Winners' Cup is the first title that Cruyff wins in his first season. The Copa del Rey, which they win in 1990, is actually the one that keeps Cruyff in a job. Mm. And without that, maybe none of this happens. They beat Real Madrid in the final 2-0. But then the four league titles in a row, and bear in mind this is a team that had never won two in a row before. This is a team that had only won two league titles in the previous 31 years and then wins four in a row. And also I think you can talk about it as a cultural change and that kind of has its legacy now, and we look at Barcelona now as a continuation of Cruyffist ideals. Now obviously it's not a completely straight line, and there are times when they've broken away from it and come back to it and so on, but in terms of the transformation of the club, so you can talk about a pre-Cruyff and a post-Cruyff era at Barcelona. Before 1990, 10 league titles and no European Cups. Since 1990, 15 league titles and 4 European Cups. And so that change, and when I say before 1990, I mean in their entire history. Mm-hmm. So the impact that it had even beyond the team itself is gigantic. And it became, of course, the dream team, this kind of image of perfection that made it impossible for anyone else to live up to it until Pep Guardiola turned up.
And so Real Madrid had won the previous five league titles before those four in a row that you mentioned. And since then, no team has won four in a row. Mm. Yeah, Pep's Barca won three, didn't they? But they are the last team to win four league titles in a row.
Yeah,
that Real Madrid team, of course, the Quinta del Buitre, which is
a classic team.
Which is a classic team, which might be saved for another episode. You never know. We should perhaps clarify for some listeners who don't necessarily know exactly who we're talking about, or some of the players that were involved in this Barcelona dream team. We're classifying it as basically Johan Cruyff's time in charge as manager. So he comes in 1988.
The same day that Espanyol were in the UEFA Cup final.
There we go.
Talk about taking the headlines off them.
Yes. And he leaves in 1996.
When he was sacked.
During that time, though, as you said, they won a number of trophies. And some of the headline players, I guess, involved would be Ronald Koeman, Romario, Pep Guardiola, Michael Laudrup,
Stoichkov, Baquero, Begiristain.
And the funny thing, of course, some of those foreigners that you mentioned, because of the rules at the time, the three foreigner rule, if you had more than three, it caused you some problems, especially if the players you're talking about are as good as those four that you just mentioned in particular.
Stoichkov did not like it when Romario turned up, although it turned out they ended up being pretty much best mates. It's curious, actually, Romario, and it's one of the things I wrote about in the book, that Romario's kind of emotional impact on this team is greater than it really was, if you see what I mean, because he was so extraordinary for a year. Because him and Stoichkov,
the 93-94 season.
Yeah, and then leading a little bit into the season after the World Cup. But the World Cup in 94, which of course Brazil won and Romario was part of that, and Stoichkov was top scorer, is kind of the part of what starts to kind of break away the foundations a little bit of this team. But those two were so extraordinary for kind of a season and a half that they've almost been, as a partnership, projected on to being the dream team forward line. But Romario, for example, only wins one league title and doesn't win the European Cup. And so it's curious, but I think there's an emotional connection to him because he was so ludicrously talented that makes him feel even bigger than perhaps he really was.
Absolutely. You mentioned he wasn't necessarily the fulcrum of this dream team, but when you think about them and you think about their forward line, Romario is the first
not least, because of course he was in the team that beat Real Madrid 5-0. He was in that team that absolutely destroyed Manchester United in the Champions League, and certainly from a British perspective, I think that's kind of one of the, you know, when people look back on that Barcelona team, they sort of remember it as being that team, whereas actually that was sort of the beginning of the end.
Other players to perhaps have a quick mention about, Ronald Koeman, who was very much a stalwart of this team.
And a goal scorer, of course.
Still, of course, the highest scoring defender in La Liga history.
I actually didn't
Sergio
know that.
Ramos is now, was it 10 goals behind? I think Koeman got 67 and Ramos has got 57, something like that.
He got to double figures in goals in every season he played at Barcelona.
It's not bad,
it's
is
quite
it?
Quite extraordinary.
He was top goal scorer in the Champions League in 1994.
I didn't.
When they got to the final, he scored 8 goals.
Crazy. And of course, he scores the goal in the final. Yeah. And he came as a kind of a deep line midfielder who became one of the three centre backs when they played three at the back. Well, I say three centre backs, it was really three defenders. They weren't even centre-backs. And one of the things that obviously makes this dream team different isn't just all of the titles that we've talked about, but it's the way they play, the way they seem to shift. Can I use a slightly Ponzi-sounding phrase, but the shift the paradigm, change the mindset of how it is you can play. And I remember having this conversation with Chicky Begiristain once and sort of saying, you know, so, and he said, you know, you buy Ronald Koeman and you go, make him a centre-back. Only pray for it at the back. Stick an extra man up front. He said, every time there was a doubt, what do we do? Cruyff went more attacking. Every time, more attacking, more players up front, more going for it. And he said, and we thought he was completely mad. And I remember saying to him, well, you know, so what do you mean? He said, well, we thought, well, this style is all well and good for the Dutch league, but you can't come here and do this in Spain, and you certainly can't do it in the Champions League when you come up against a strong English team or a German team. But Cruyff kept on kind of doubling down on this. I said, well, so how did he convince you? And he said, well, because it's Johan Cruyff. And he just had this kind of, you know, obviously everything he'd been as a player, everything he'd symbolised, everything he represented, the power of his own convictions, which at times could be overbearing, and some of the players, you know, didn't always get on brilliantly with him. But there was definitely something different about Cruyff that changed the way people, not just the way that people played the game, but the way that people thought about it.
And that is illustrated by the fact, something that's been discussed a lot recently, for example, Jonathan Wilson wrote a book about it, The Barcelona Legacy. When you run through that list of names of players, the number of them who have gone on to be coaches in themselves, influenced by Cruyff as a kind of inspirational figure.
Yeah, and obviously that has a kind of a, that expands then into people like Van Gaal, into Bobby Robson, into even to Jose Mourinho. But that idea that somehow when you work with Cruyff, you rethink and you kind of reconceptualize the way that the game should be played. That's not necessarily to say it makes you absolutely right. And Cruyff, for example, is not the same as Guardiola. I mean, Guardiola is very, very different in his approach.
Well, some of it's a reaction to Cruyff as well as being inspired by him, I guess.
I think that's true.
Romario didn't go on to be a coach.
No. Went on to be a politician.
He's an MP.
Which is completely baffling as well, because he wasn't really what you anticipated. I loved his comment where not so long ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, his son had signed up for a Brazilian club. I must confess, I can't remember which one it was. And Romario said, well, I'll go to watch his games, but I don't think I'll be going to his training sessions. After all, I never even went to my own. But he was just so incredibly talented that it sort of didn't matter. And of course, very famous for turning Rafael Alcorta inside out with what became known as the collar of the Vaca, that swish across the floor.
The cow's tail.
Oh, brilliant. Mm. Just brilliant.
We'll talk about a couple more of the important members of the team in just a second. But it's important perhaps to pick up on something you were touching upon there. The emotional significance of this team, not just necessarily in terms of the titles won, but in the way that it was won and the way that they played and the way that they sort of stamped and created an identity of football for Barcelona, which is very much the current way of doing things.
Yeah, and at the very least, even when it's not necessarily the current way of doing things, it becomes the ideal to which everyone must aspire.
Yes.
So and at times, of course, that's a problem for managers, because it becomes a sort of Damocles hanging over them that they can't ever really match up to this. And, you know, if you want a great case study in how difficult it can be, just look at what happened to Bobby Robson when he had to follow Cruyff. It was almost impossible. I think it was difficult then for Van Gaal, whose team actually did really quite well, admittedly less well in Europe and weren't quite as exciting, but, you know, won the league title in the first two seasons. And it just kind of wasn't enough. And as I say, it wasn't really enough until Guardiola came along. And of course, Guardiola, a declared Cruyffist, the midfielder from the middle of the Cruyff team, at a time when actually, you know, no one really knew very much about this skinny kid who came up through the youth system. And it's Cruyff who says, right, this is the guy I want in there. Because he could see that the understanding of the game, even if, as I say, Guardiola's broken a lot of the things that Cruyff did and gone away from a lot of the things that Cruyff did, and not least he's a much harder worker in terms of the detail and the kind of repetition of certain things than Cruyff was, but very definitely a Cruyffist. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Guardiola then, who was very much a big part of this dream team, made his debut for Barcelona age 19 against Cadiz in December 1990, went on to play more than 380 games over an 11-year period. He is one of the members of the Dream Team that you will have actually seen play quite a lot, not when he was in the Dream Team, but subsequently, obviously. Yeah. Here's a question. Did you ever, when you watched him play, was he someone who you thought he will go on and be a coach, he could be a leader?
Yeah, and not just because of the way that he played, but actually because of the way he talked even then, that you could see that there was a conviction about him. You could see that there was a sense that he wanted to not just do things this way, but wanted others to do things this way. That if you watched the way that he played, he was the kind of, if you like, what's the best phrase for this? I suppose the metronome. So he was a bit like Xavi would become later, but from a slightly deeper position. It was pass, 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 pass. Make sure the pass goes to the right person at the right kind of pace. He would change not just the direction of the play, but the speed of the play. And in that sense, I think there was a very clear idea very, very early with Guardiola that this guy thinks about the game differently to others. I mean, bear in mind that in the presidential elections, which I think it's the ones that bring Laporta in as president, Guardiola had been on the ticket with a guy called Bassat, and he was going to be the sporting director at Barcelona. This is way before he ever became the manager. He was going to be the sporting director with his coach was going to be Juan Malillo, who of course is now coaching Andres Iniesta in Japan. And so there was a sense even then that this is a guy who thinks about things differently, maybe won't be a coach, but will play some sort of role, and that role will be partly educational. And I think we saw this recently, didn't he? He admitted recently that one day he'll go back to Barcelona, but not to coach a team, to run the youth system. Hmm. Well, at least that's his aspiration. Whether they'll let him is another issue.
Well, they got to let him, haven't they? I mean, surely.
Yeah, although the relationship between Guardiola and this current board isn't that great.
Yes, but perhaps sometime in the future, the board in the future might let the most successful manager in the history of Barcelona come back and coach the youth team. He did become the most successful manager after Cruyff, because Cruyff had set the bar for Guardiola to follow. Guardiola said of the dream team that they were pioneers, and we cannot compete with that no matter how many trophies we win.
Well, you wonder if Guardiola may well be the next generation's Cruyff in the same way that we've talked about, influencing, inspiring, whether it's a reaction to him or not. He is kind of the next generation.
Well, and in terms of the pressure that I was saying earlier about, you know, how difficult it was, for example, for Bobby Robson to follow Cruyff, and how difficult it was for Van Gaal to follow Cruyff, I think we've already seen this. We saw it with Luis Enrique. I think we're seeing it with Ernesto Valverde.
Yeah.
You follow Guardiola and you're following this slightly idealised and slightly mythologised with time vision of a kind of an unattainable perfection.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it?
I mean, they've done all right.
I know exactly what that's what I mean. Luis Enrique wins a treble in his first season, but it's not just about winning, is it? That's the thing. With Cruyff, Barcelona created a footballing narrative to go with the social political narrative, the cultural narrative they always had. They created a kind of a footballing puritanism.
Well, that's the thing, and the danger of that becoming like a kind of gospel is if you go against that, you're like a heretic.
Absolutely.
And that's not the way that we do things, whether it's successful or not.
Well, I think it was Pichi Alonso who said, you know, Cruyff is God and the word of God cannot be contradicted.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
All right, so we've spoken about Romario, Koeman, Guardiola. Wanted to quickly mention Michael Laudrup as well, just because we're all swooning.
Yeah,
just
to the swooning beer. In every sense.
He's still a handsome man.
He's a lovely man as well.
He was also an absolutely bloody brilliant footballer. I'm sort of more familiar with his performances for Real Madrid.
Mm. Well, and there's a nice kind of 12-month period where, as Sid writes in his book, Laudrup was on the right side of 5-0 victories for both Barca, and then a year later, Real Madrid.
Exactly a year later, they win 5-0 with Barcelona, and then he goes to Real Madrid, wins 5-0 in Real Madrid in two Clásicos, and he's in the dressing room, and Ángel Capa, who was a Real Madrid assistant coach at the time, tells a story that he's in the dressing room, everyone's celebrating, and Laudrup's just sitting there very quietly in the corner, and as he walks past him, kind of Laudrup looks at him and just says, "I won 10-0. Which I think is brilliant. My favourite Laudrup story is not that one though. My favourite.
I think you've told this one about the king.
About the king. Have I told this one before? I'll tell it anyway.
If you haven't heard.
So Laudrup is at the end of his whatever it is, a year and a bit at Real Madrid. He decides he's going to go, and he's eating in a restaurant one day, and he discovers that the king of Spain is sitting on the other table, Juan Carlos, and Juan Carlos comes over, and Juan Carlos says to him, "So I hear you're leaving." And Laudrup says, yeah, I am. And he says, "Well, that's good. I can go back to being the only king in Madrid."
which is a good story, which you have told. Actually, feels quite fairly recently that you told that.
I don't
but anyway,
know.
It's a good one.
I'm sorry if I have.
Sorry, Phil. I was just going to say that the sad thing about Laudrup, in a way, is that you get the impression that Cruyff, whether it was because Cruyff saw a bit of himself in Laudrup or whatever, didn't give Laudrup the kind of the encouragement, the support that he needed. Of course, Laudrup was famously left out of the 94 European Cup final, the one that Milan won. So comprehensively 4-0. 4-0.
In Athens, yeah.
Yes, yeah. It didn't end particularly well for Laudrup at Barcelona. Is it coincidence that the season that he leaves, Barcelona don't win the league the following season and Real Madrid do?
Not entirely coincidence, no. I think there's a series of elements. One is the impact of that lost final in 94. I think the other, as I said before, is the impact of the post-World Cup season in which Stoichkov, Romario, the impact of Romario's own kind of rebellion, the tensions that were already there. I mean, you know, this split that we always talk about, the kind of the civil war, if you like, at Barcelona, which in a way was kind of Cruyffists against Nunezists, for want of a better word, which has kind of been recreated even now, was already starting to build up. And the day that Cruyff is sacked is really quite brutal, and the players literally listening as Cruyff and Joan Gaspar, the then vice president, go at each other and really scream and shout at each other, and Cruyff sacked the next day.
Okay, any other players that you'd like to mention before
Stoichkov.
We talk about other things? Tell us about Risto Stoichkov.
I mean, Stoichkov's just completely crazy.
He still is.
Yeah, he still is. And fans loved him for his craziness. And you know, Cruyff always said that he wanted Stoichkov as much for his personality, maybe a Luis Suarez-style figure. You know, he wanted someone with mala leche and that bad milk, that aggression on the pitch, the nastiness. And my favourite bit was there was this story that the only thing that he had to do really to convince Stoichkov to come, and it can't have been that difficult to convince someone to come from Bulgaria, from behind the Iron Curtain still, to come and play for Barcelona. Brilliant player. But the way to convince him was to get him a red sports car. All he wanted was a red sports car, according to the story. And I asked Stoichkov this, and he said, yeah, that's true. And he said, red. It was an Audi, he said, but it didn't matter. It didn't need to be an Audi, just a red car, any red car. It had to be a red car. And then he said, I didn't have a license. Well, fair enough.
Was it? He was driving it though. I'm sure.
I assume so. Oh, yeah.
I think
to be fair to him, I think he probably meant he just didn't have a Spanish license.
Oh, yeah.
But he said, I didn't have a license. Okay.
That's all right. We don't have Spanish licenses.
No, that's true.
Don't mention that on air. Look, Stoichkov was the prototype mercurial, combative little Balkan playmaker. I mean, I really remember him. I guess our generation was a bit
just
past his best. Yeah, and then Euro 96. Even at Euro 96, he was past it, but he scored a couple of brilliant
goals. I saw him play in Leeds.
I think he scored three goals in Euro 96, and there were a couple of brilliant goals I remember in particular, even though, as I say, that was when he was past
what
his
a
best.
What a great player. And he fell out very badly later on with Van Gaal, but he absolutely loved
because
Bobby
he went
Robson.
And came back, didn't he?
Yeah, he went to, was it Palmer in between time? I think it might have been. And he absolutely loved Bobby Robson, but hated Van Gaal.
Is it worth, at this point, addressing the kind of the counter narrative about the Dream Team? The counter narrative being, how good were they really, and how lucky were they?
Uh-huh.
Well, because of course the story, obviously I think a lot of people know, but it's worth going through these. They won four league titles. Mm. Three of the four they won on the final day, and in all three cases
against Deportivo La Coruña,
which we talked about when we did Super Deportivo, of course, in all three cases it was basically handed to them by the other team somehow blowing it. Now we're not going to go through Super Depor again because we did it the other day, but of course this comes to the damned island, the cursed island, the Tenerife. Two seasons in a row, Real Madrid go to Tenerife on the final day of the season, knowing that if they win, they win the league, and both times they were beaten. The first time they were beaten 3-2, which is an extraordinary. I mean, it was done. You know, they were 2-0 up, the league's theirs, and they lose 3-2. The second season, they go, and it's almost as if the first season mean they know they're going to lose, because like, there's this kind of curse, there's this mental thing that says, we can't go here again, we're going to lose it again. And both times they hand the league to Barcelona. There's a couple of reasons why this is significant. Obviously, one of the fundamental ones is that the Tenerife manager is Jorge Valdano, former player who then becomes their manager. And I remember him saying that he felt that he had to become Real Madrid's manager when they offered it to him because he owed them, because he'd taken two league titles off them.
So they were somewhat lucky in winning three.
By the way, have you ever
four.
Seen the goal in the first one? It is possibly the most stupid goal you will ever, ever
see in your
life.
The winning goal?
I think it's the 2-2, but it might be the 3-2. Basically, Manolo Sanchez picks the ball up more or less on the halfway line, turns round and decides to deliver a back pass to Paco Bullo. From the halfway line, he's thumped this back pass. It's flying through the air. I think it's going wide, but Bullo scrambles across to try and get to it, reaches, because it's high in the air, this isn't on the floor, reaches it, saves it from going out for a corner, but basically saves it, pushes it backwards onto the goal line, and a guy called Cherubino or something like that runs in and scores. It's one of the most stupid goals you could ever, ever wish to see.
which helped out the dream team considerably.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and this was one of the things. Tenerife were actually invited to play in the Trofeo Gamper, the kind of the pre-season
pre-season
tournament. Exactly. And there was always a suggestion that maybe they'd been on a little bit win bonus from Barcelona, which of course back then I suspect there's a reasonable chance they were, because a lot of teams were. But Real Madrid blew it both times. Except that I mentioned this to Michel once, and we'll talk about him when we do Quinta del Buitre, I'm sure, if we do Quinta del Buitre, as one of our classic teams. And I remember him saying, yeah, but it's true we blew on the last day, and it's true that we completely cocked it up. But he said, in a way, it was a miracle that we kept up with that dream team. He said, because they were much, much better than us. Oh. And he said, so it feels to me, he said, with time, he said, obviously, in that moment, I didn't feel like this. He said, with time, it feels to me like we did something extraordinary, even reaching the final day with a chance of winning the league.
Oh, well, there you go. If it comes from Michel, who would know, really, would
yes.
you?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So, an element of luck about three of those league titles, the European Cup that they won in 1992 at Wembley against Sampdoria, they only won it 1-0 after extra time, the Koeman goal wins it. And then, of course, the other European Cup final they get to that we've touched on, they were spanked 4-0 by Milan.
They get absolutely slaughtered, and there was always an accusation that Cruyff hadn't taken it seriously enough. In fairness to Cruyff, in the pre-match press conference, he was saying, I'm worried about the fact that the environment around us isn't taking this seriously enough. Obviously, Barcelona just won a fourth league title in a row. That's the Deportivo league title, I think the fourth one of the four. And Barcelona's players felt like, you know, somehow, I mean, we keep getting away with this.
Well, yeah,
there is something about us. We're just untouchable. Even when we're bad, we're untouchable. And they got totally taken apart. That team. If I remember rightly, in the final, the player that really kind of strode across that final was Marcel Desailly.
Yeah,
he was absolutely wonderful.
Well, I think he scored the fourth goal, didn't he?
I can't remember which one it was.
I think it was the fourth. And also that Milan team. When you look at the players that weren't even playing, they were without Baresi, Costa Curta. There was no Van Basten. There was no Brian Laudrup. There was no Papa. They were missing about half the top players, and they still absolutely demolished Barcelona, who were the favourites.
A brief aside, Costa Curta, it sounds like a Geordie supermarket, doesn't it? Costa Curta? Cost cutter in jewelry, like, yeah. Huh? Anyway, that was terrible.
But,
sorry,
but despite all that,
just ruined this whole thing.
They were still a great team. Of course, they were a great team.
They
of
really were.
Such an influential
they absolutely
team.
Were.
But perhaps maybe their importance is actually something that it's more sort of cultural,
ideological. Philosophical.
Yes. It's as the Guardiola quote that you mentioned earlier has it. It's as a kind of a pioneer, as a groundbreaker, as something to follow. Something to create a pathway for others to follow along. And as I say, and it's been slightly exaggerated by all of us, I include myself, the kind of line of continuity, because that line of continuity is not quite as clear cut as it appears. But it definitely gave them an identity that until then they hadn't had. Although it is true that some of the players of the pre Cruyff era, kind of the 86 European Cup team and the team that won the league in 85, some of those players feel that their contribution to the modern Barcelona has been overlooked and shouldn't have been, with Terry, that team that with Terry Venables won the league and lost the European Cup final to Stade Bucharest.
Okay. Well, there we go. That was the Barcelona dream team. We've been taking your suggestions. Obviously, quite a few people have suggested doing the dream team. Quite a few people suggested a Eurodepo. We have heeded those suggestions in our first two episodes of Classic Teams. Make sure you tell us who you want us to do, patrons. Amin said, I'd like to put forward the Del Bosque era Real Madrid team from the turn of the century for your Classic Teams series. I'm
Does
a Madridista.
Pre-Galactico or including Galactico?
Well, maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, maybe.
He says, I'm a Madridista, and while there are many things that happen at the club that baffle me, the sacking of Del Bosque is the one I really can't get my head around. Ian said, turn of the century Valencia or Barca dream team next. Well, there you go, Ian. Good suggestions. And Quaid says, I was wondering if you'd consider doing the 1979-1980 Real Madrid Castilla team for your Classic Teams series. It sounds pretty niche, but of course that was a Real Madrid Castilla team that got to the Copa del Rey final and were beaten 6-1 by Real Madrid, which is something perhaps worth talking about, because
that feeds into a little bit into the whole idea of the Quinta del Buitre, and the whole idea of that
sort of
that
a precursor,
that young generation of players coming through at Madrid in what was, of course, a fledgling democracy at the time.
Yes, very, very, very interesting. There we go. All right, so we will have a think and come up with another classic team to talk about on our next episode. But as I said, make sure you tell us who you want us to talk about.
And you're more than welcome to ask for Oviedo, by the way.
You are. You will be rejected, but you can ask.
You can ask. You may not be listened to.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Bye.
Cheerio.